You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, the world's first legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. Hello and welcome to episode 45 of the Study Legal English podcast. I am your host Louise and today we are continuing with the topic of the history of the judiciary of England and Wales. I'll be reading the second part of the article we started last week. The article is published at www.judiciary.uk and so if you want more or less the transcript of this show, you can visit the website for the article. Last week we covered the first 500 years of the evolution of the judiciary and today we'll deal with the next 500 years. So let's get started. Part 2. From 1540 onwards, Henry VIII had no judges in his Privy Council. His son Edward VI and daughter Mary I did include judges on their own Privy Councils, but Elizabeth I excluded them for 40 years. In 1553, Mary I also removed three judges from office, but Elizabeth I made no changes on assuming the throne, although she did remove one later during her reign. The judiciary were becoming separate from the executive, although it was generally accepted at this time that even the king was subject to the laws of the land. The Reformation added to the sovereign's powers. The state had taken over the church's privilege to define the laws of God and had removed the influence of the Pope as the ultimate arbiter on earth. So the king remained principal lawmaker with the judges as interpreters of that law, a potentially uneasy relationship. Meanwhile, by the Elizabethan and early Stuart periods, assize judges on the six circuits in England were mainly dealing with the most serious crimes not normally handled by the local quarter sessions run by justices of the peace. They also took a role in local administration, although this was much reduced following the English Civil War. A risky business. On the face of it, the judiciary was becoming steadily more independent. In 1642, Charles I was forced to agree to the appointment of judges during good behaviour, and their salaries were raised from under £200 to £1,000 a year in 1645. On the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, all judges, and there were just 12 at this point, four in each of the common law courts, remained in office. But in 1668, the system of appointments, during pleasure, was reintroduced, and in the last 11 years of his reign, Charles II sacked 11 of his judges. The next king, Charles's brother, James II, sacked 12 in just 3 years. This was bound to affect the quality of the judiciary. Judges knew very well their jobs were at risk if the sovereign did not like their judgments. A new independence. The day after the House of Commons resolved that James II had abdicated, a parliamentary committee drew up heads of grievances to be presented to the new King William III. The document contained, among other things, items on paying judges' salaries out of public funds and preventing judges being removed or suspended from office, unless by due cause of law. These grievances eventually appeared in much the same form in the Act of Settlement, 1701, and have remained in place ever since. When common law failed. Mirroring developments in the role and independence of judges were changes to the avenues of redress open to aggrieved parties. The common law system was an improvement on what had gone before, but it was still slow, highly technical, making procedural mistakes that could ruin a case all too likely, and vulnerable to corruption, especially when juries were used. Fortunately, those who felt they had been failed by the common law system could still petition the king with their grievances. Gradually, these cases were delegated to the king's counsel and eventually to one individual, the Lord Chancellor. Because of this, the Lord Chancellor came to be known as the King's Conscience and began to preside over his own court, the Court of Chancery. This dealt only with civil disputes, for example, property and contract cases, and applied the law of equity, even-handedness or fairness. By the time of Henry VIII, the Court of Chancery had become a rival to the common law courts, but as the years went by, the Court of Chancery began to be known for the same problems it had been set up to combat: expense and delay. Also, the Lord Chancellor was free to give whatever ruling he liked in a Chancery court, unbound by the law, which made it almost impossible for lawyers to advise their clients correctly. Changes to the system. It was not until 1830 that there was any change to the nearly 300-year-old Assize Courts. By the Law Terms Act of that year, the Court of Great Sessions was abolished and the Welsh counties and Chester were brought into the General Circuit system. Shortly afterwards, the new Central Criminal Court was set up, unifying the administration of justice in London and surrounding areas. In 1856, judges of the Central Criminal Court were also given the right to hear cases outside the court's ordinary jurisdiction to ensure a fair trial where local prejudice existed, or when it could offer an early trial and so avoid the delay involved in waiting for the next assizes. County courts dealing with civil cases were created under the County Courts Act 1846. The Judicature Act 1873 and after. In 1873, Parliament passed the Judicature Act, which merged common law and equity. Although one of the divisions of the High Court is still called Chancery, all courts could now administer both equity and common law, with equity to reign supreme in any dispute. The same act established the High Court and the Court of Appeal and provided a right of appeal in civil cases to the Court of Appeal. Criminal appeal rights remained limited until the establishment of a Court of Criminal Appeal under the Criminal Appeal Act 1907. The Court of Criminal Appeal sat for nearly 60 years until its existence as a separate body was ended by the Criminal Appeal Act 1966. Its jurisdiction passed to the Court of Appeal. The Crown Court is created. Crown courts, as we know them today, were not actually established until 1956, and then only in Liverpool and Manchester. These courts also took over the Court of Sessions work in their cities. The Royal Commission on Assizes and Court of Sessions, 1966 to 1969, led to the abolition of Courts of Assize and Court of Sessions, and the establishment of a new Crown Court to deal with business from both, under the terms of the Courts Act 1971. But still not separate. Hundreds of years of evolution may have resulted in an independent judiciary, but that doesn't mean they were entirely separate from the government. Chief Justice Lord Mansfield was in the cabinet between 1757 and 1765, for example. And more recently, Lord Cave was Home Secretary for a couple of months at the end of the First World War, when he was also serving Lord of Appeal in Ordinary or Law Lord. And until 2006, the Lord Chancellor was part of the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. The Lord Chancellor's role changed drastically on April the 3rd, 2006, as a result of the Constitutional Reform Act 2005. This latest major change to affect the judiciary has been described as the most significant since the Magna Carta. The Act establishes the Lord Chief Justice as President of the Courts of England and Wales and Head of the Judiciary, a role previously performed by the Lord Chancellor. For the first time, an express statutory duty is placed on the Lord Chancellor and other ministers of the Crown to protect the independence of the judiciary. For the first time in its 1,000-year history, the judiciary is officially recognised as a fully independent branch of the government. Great. So that's the end of this episode. Next time, we'll be looking at an overview of the court system which exists today. Don't forget that as a podcast pro member, there are lots of resources for you at studylegalenglish.com/episode45. And if you like this show, if you have any comments, then drop me a line at info@studylegalenglish.com. You know that I would love to hear from you. So thanks for listening and see you next time.